This week we continue our series, American Places, based on the book of that title published by Oxford University Press. We've invited some of the contributors to that volume, prominent historians all, to share with us both their professional and personal responses to those physical traces of the past that make history come alive for them. This week we investigate two of America's historic ballparks, Fenway Park in Boston and the Polo Grounds in New York. I'd like to welcome John Demas to Talking History. Demas is the Samuel Knight Professor of History at Yale University. He's also the author of one of the chapters in American Places on Boston's legendary home of the Red Sox, Fenway Park. Welcome, Professor Demas.
Nice to be here.
First of all, the complete title of your piece is A Fan's Homage to Fenway. How did you come to be a fan of the Red Sox and a Fenway Park?
In 1946, the Red Sox won the American League pennant in a rather glorious season. It ended, alas, so many things do with the Red Sox, tragically, when they lost the World Series in the seventh game to the St. Louis Cardinal. But I was 9 years old, just beginning to become aware of baseball and sports and the wider world generally. And as I say, it was a wonderful summer for Boston sports fans, and I just was swept up in the atmosphere of that moment. And I've been a Red Sox fan ever since.
Do you have any professional connections? You're an early American historian, and that certainly predates even Fenway, as old as it is.
Well, I think the connection is not exactly a direct one, yet there is a sense in which baseball, I think, is founded in a kind of sense of history. I think all baseball fans feel the kind of merging, as it were, of the present and the past to a much greater degree, it seems to me, than is true for other sports. So there is a kind of emotional level in which it seems to me being a historian and being a rabid baseball fan kind of goes together.
I think that why it makes such a good entry for American Places. But why the parenthetical remark in your title? I think you alluded to it earlier, perhaps, but you said, or you wrote, or why we love it when they always break our hearts.
Well, the saying that the Red Sox always break your heart is very common in the world of Boston sports fandom. And there is a sense, I think, too, that to be a Red Sox fan is something of a masochistic status, that there's something about this endless disappointment and torment and tragic defeat, which we have come to sort of groove on, if I can put it that way. I'm not quite sure why this should be true, but it's what we expect. It's almost what we welcome.
Most a reference to that curse of the Babe idea, or Babe Ruth. That,
exactly. Never been the same since they traded the Bambino.
When was Fenway Park erected, and how does it actually fit into the early history of the Red Sox?
The Red Sox themselves, as a team, were begun in around the year 1900. I believe they were at first called the Pilgrims, the Boston Pilgrims, and the name was changed in 1907, I think it was, to the Red Sox, presumably because of their costume, that element of their costume. And at first they played in an old wood stadium called the Huntington Park Baseball Grounds, I believe. And in 1911, actually, I guess, the plans were laid for a new stadium that would become Fenway Park. That was part of a business decision, I assume, by the family that owned the team at the time. I think they were getting ready to sell the Red Sox, and they thought it would be a better deal for them if a park was part of the deal. And Fenway was actually, I believe, one of the first steel and concrete stadiums anywhere in the country.
Hmm. Where did the name Fenway come from?
Well, it really comes from the locale, the area in which the park was built. Fenway, in the sense of fens, an old kind of swamp, which had, I believe, been filled in not long before the park was built.
Now, you quote John Updike's description of Fenway Park as, quote, a lyric little bandbox of a ballpark. In your own words, what are the defining characteristics? What do you think of? What comes to mind, sort of physical elements, even when you think of Fenway Park?
It's, I think it's very unique, very, very, at least very distinctive as a stadium structure. It has many little eccentricities and idiosyncrasies. Of course, the most famous single feature of Fenway Park, and perhaps one might even argue of any stadium anywhere in the country, is the famous Green Monster, the huge green wall which runs all along the left field side of the park, 37 feet high and all of that. It's an overwhelming kind of visual feature when you first walk into the park. But there are many other little distinguishing marks, so to speak. The bullpens that are tucked up right against the bleachers so that there's a lot of conversation that goes on between the relief pitchers and the bleacher fans. The way in which the stadium juts oddly onto the field just past third base. The box seats are practically in the coaching box there. The concession stands that are scattered in a totally random way, it seems, around the park. There's just no other place like it. So that's, I think that's part of it. But beyond that, and I think that John Updike had this in mind as well, there is a kind of extraordinary feeling of intimacy and closeness about the park, about being in the park. There's no seat which doesn't give you a sense that you're really right up against the action.
Right, I think that's right.
And the players themselves often comment on this, that they can hear almost everything that's said in the stands and so forth and so on.
Right. Well, you're right now, and being an historian, you begin to make connections in your piece. You say Fenway is the oldest major league stadium in regular use anywhere in the country. That's important. But then you also make the point that it's also in Boston, which is arguably the oldest of our major cities. And then you suggest several connections, physical, historical, in terms of population, shared culture. Let's talk about perhaps each one of those, perhaps with physical links between Fenway Park and Boston.
Well, just as Fenway, I've just been saying, is a relatively small-scale and intimate and very distinctive sort of a place, so too, I think, is Boston as a city. If you compare it to the other big cities in this country, again, there's a kind of smallness of scale, a feeling that you can walk the neighborhoods, that you don't need freeways and elaborate subway systems and so forth to get around. It really is a kind of walking town, which seems to connect it at some level to Fenway. There are many other, more, you might say, more cultural aspects where I think there's also a connection. The history of Boston is very much, in my mind anyway, very much in the background of the Fenway experience and the experience of being a Red Sox fan.
I thought you're tracing the history from roughly 1912 through the 1930s was particularly interesting. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the Red Sox in their early years were, in fact, the single most successful professional baseball team in the country. They won the pennant and the World Series several times in the 19-teens, I think four times. Even before they came to Fenway, in fact, they were, I think, generally recognized as the best team year in and year out. And so this continued to be true up until around 1920. Then came the famous moment when Babe Ruth was traded away to the Yankees. And in fact, I think the then owner was seriously strapped for cash so that he not only sold Babe Ruth, but a lot of other top players as well. And the team slid steadily and rapidly downhill and became a sort of cellar level team all through the 1920s. It wasn't until the 30s, in fact, that things began to right themselves in terms of their record. And since then, it's been this kind of mixed bag.
You referred earlier to cultural links. Are there any other links that you would want to mention at this point?
Well, I think there is a sense in which Boston, too, the history of Boston begins from very successful and you might even say rather glorious beginnings all through late 17th and on well into the 18th century, and indeed through the period of the American Revolution and so on. Boston was really the premier American city, the most important city in terms of economics, in terms of political influence, and so forth and so on. The place where, as much as any place else, at least, the revolution was, the American Revolution was made. And that carries through and well into the and through the 19th century. Bostonians ever since that time some have referred to themselves as, well, have referred to their city as the Athens of America or the hub of the universe, words which are meant to convey this sense of being first. But then, by the late 19th century, if one is honest about the facts, it's clear that Boston has entered a period of long decline. So like the Red Sox, in short, there's this this glorious past and then a something of a descent since then.
You compare Fenway Park to a few other landmarks in Boston. This is a subject that we've addressed in the series earlier. So what constitutes an historic landmark, and why do we value it? How do you compare a place like Fenway Park to the more obvious examples like Faneuil Hall or Beacon Hill or Paul Revere's house?
Well, all those places you mention are something like local shrines, not only for Bostonians, but for people who come from all over to visit the city. I think it probably could be argued that Boston's tourism is more based on history and historical monuments than would be true of any other leading American city. And so Fenway has that aspect as well. It's old just the way Boston is old. It's a kind of physical monument to past glory, the way some of these other sites in Boston have a similar kind of significance. That's the connection, I think.
Do you think there would be any situation wherein they would actually tear it down? I know there's been some talk about it over the years.
Well, there's been a lot of talk in the last several years, and I'm sure it's coming sooner or later. In many ways, Fenway Park could be said not to work anymore from a business standpoint, basically. It's small now, and certainly compared to most other parks. It's clear that a great many more tickets could be sold if the seats were available. The park is sold out virtually every game throughout the summer. I tried to get tickets myself recently, and it was almost impossible. From a business standpoint, something larger is needed, and people say something more modern, something fancier is needed. All of that gets into sort of the nostalgia factor. Those of us who've been going to Fenway for 50 years and more love, in some ways, the antiquity of it. But it's out of step, you might say, with the way professional sports operates, by and large, these days.
All right. Well, Boston has faced this, I know, with the garden and other old structures and had to make some tough decisions. But you have to wonder, and I know there's probably no way you can predict this, but if you were to tear down Fenway Park, how many of those fans go because of the nostalgia or the connection? I know many people that leave Boston go back just to see Fenway Park again, and if there happens to be a game there, well, that's wonderful. But
my guess is that, in fact, a lot of fans, including myself, would be very sad. But because the Red Sox, at least, the team would carry over from the one setting to the new one, probably we'd be right back there the next year.
Well, it is a wonderful park, and I really enjoyed your piece. I would highly recommend it to anyone who gets a copy of American Places. So thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You've been listening to John Demas, Samuel Knight Professor of History at Yale University and one of the contributing authors to American Places, and this is Talking History.
Jojo DiMaggio, we like you white hearts.
He live in baseball's Hall of Fame. He got there blow by blow. Our kids will tell their kids his name, Jolton Joe DiMaggio.
We dream of Joey with the light from back. Jojo DiMaggio,
we want you on our side.
Unlike Fenway Park, the Polo Grounds has not survived. But in the 1920s, despite its unlikely name, it was a primary showcase for the golden age of baseball. and it has not escaped the attention of historian Jules Teigel in the book American Places. Teigel is professor of history at San Francisco State University and the author of Baseball's Great Experiment, Jackie Robinson and His Legacy.
I first experienced the Polo Grounds in its afterlife. 5 years after it had been abandoned by the New York Giants, it was now the home of the hapless New York Mets. I went to the ballpark with my boyhood friend Robert Doran. We were both 13 years old, just past our bar mitzvahs. This in itself was a rite of passage, as we went into Manhattan, took the long subway ride up to Upper Manhattan and to the Polo Grounds. There we saw the Mets play the Philadelphia Phillies. The Mets immediately fell behind 11-1, staged a fruitless rally bringing them to 11-9, got the tying run to home plate, and then lost the game when Don Zimmer struck out for the final out. We did not know then the long and venerable history of the Polo Grounds. The Polo Grounds had begun in a lower part of Manhattan, at a place where they actually played polo, and then where the Giants began playing in the 1880s. However, they moved uptown to a site underneath an area called Coogan's Bluff, along the Harlem River, just across from the Bronx, where Yankee Stadium would later be built. In the early 20th century, the Polo Grounds became the home to the great Giant teams led by manager John McGraw and Christy Mathewson. Two earlier versions of the Polo Grounds were destroyed, one by fire on April 4, 1911. The new Polo Grounds, one of the great modern concrete and steel stadiums, was built that year, and eight of the first 11 seasons, the Giants won pennants, leading to the golden age of the 1920s. In the 1920s, the ballpark was known not for the Giants, its most famous residents, but for many other sporting events as well. First of all, the Yankees played there in those years. And so when Babe Ruth arrived to play for the Yankees in 1920, he arrived at the Polo Grounds. And indeed, much of his home run hitting prowess in 1920 and 1921, when he astonished the world by hitting over 50 home runs in both seasons, was accounted to by the short right field porch in the Polo Grounds. In fact, when the Yankees left and moved to Yankee Stadium, Babe Ruth said, "I cried when they took me out of the Polo Grounds." The Polo Grounds also became the home of the World Series almost every year. Between 1921 and 1924, when both the Giants and the Yankees were often in the World Series, the Polo Grounds hosted 19 out of 26 World Series games. It also was the home for college football. The Army-Navy game was usually played at the Polo Grounds in the 20s. And in 1924, in a game involving Notre Dame, sports writer Grantland Rice dubbed the backfield for Notre Dame the Four Horsemen, one of the more memorable sports writing events. In 1925, Red Grange made his professional debut with the Chicago Bears playing against the New York Giants, and tens of thousands of fans stormed the Polo Grounds, establishing the viability of professional football at that time. The professional Giants would play there until 1956. There were also great boxing matches at the Polo Grounds. The first $1 million gate took place there when Jack Dempsey defeated Luis Angel Firpo, the Wild Bull of the Pampas. And in 1941, Joe Louis knocked out Billy Kahn in the 13th round after telling people that Kahn could run, but he couldn't hide. What's most memorable about the Polo Grounds was its great odd configuration. It had a horseshoe shape, which made the dimensions of the field quite unusual. The right field fence was only 257 feet from home plate. The left field fence was only 279 feet from home plate. But a great overhang sticking out 25 feet often caught home runs hit as little as 250 feet as outfielders camped underneath waiting to catch them. Center field, on the other hand, was 450 feet away. Only one regular season home run was ever hit into those vast center field bleachers until 1962, the first Mets season. There, on consecutive days, Lou Brock and Hank Aaron each hit home runs into the center field bleachers. Perhaps the most enduring memory of the ballpark and the most enduring description of the perverse nature of these dimensions occurred in 1954 during the World Series. In a game between the Giants and the Cleveland Indians, with the Giants ahead by one run and Larry Doby on second base, Vic Wertz hit a tremendous blast to center field. Willie Mays, perhaps the only man who could have caught the ball, took off heading for the center field bleachers. With his back to the home plate, Mays caught the ball, basket-style catch, wheeled and threw, preventing Dobie from scoring all the way from second. It remains one of the most memorable events in baseball history. Several innings later, in extra innings, Dusty Rhodes, a Giant pinch hitter, came up and hit an easy fly ball that drifted out to right field. The right fielder backed up against the fence, and there, just 250 away, watched as the ball first hit into the first row of the stands, then bounced back as his feet as the Giants won the game. The other famous home run of the Polo Grounds was Bobby Thompson's 1951 shot heard round the world. The Polo Grounds was ultimately knocked down in 1964 when the Mets moved to a new ballpark in Queens. It had hosted many famous events, many sports, but the only game that was probably never played at the Polo Grounds was polo itself.
You've been listening to Jules Teigel, author of Pastime, Baseball as History. This is Talking History.
By a score of 5-4, and they're picking Bobby Thompson up and carrying.